to The Sound of Economics. In today's episode, we are discussing the topic of economic resilience in our own countries, but also globally in a world that is deeply interconnected. My name is Maria Demergis, and I'm the Deputy Director of Bruegel. The topic of economic resilience has featured very prominently in the recent G7 meetings, in which a panel was put together to discuss these issues and come up with a number of recommendations. One of the authors of this report is Bruegel Senior Fellow Thomas Wieser, who joins me today. Hello, Thomas. Welcome to the episode.
Good morning, Maria. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming. And my other guest today is Professor Andres Sapir, who is also a Senior Fellow at Bruegel and a very knowledgeable commentator on the issues that the report is discussing. Hi, Andre. Welcome.
Hello, Maria. Hello, Thomas.
Good to see you again, Andre. Let me start by saying that we are now in the second of what we once used to call once-in-a-lifetime crisis in the space of just over 10 years. And these are crises that are at the global scale. What we thought might have once been once-in-a-lifetime event now happens rather more frequently, like I said, two in a space of just over 10 years. I feel we ought to rethink the frequency of these crises. What we used to call extreme events are becoming slightly more normalized. But, you know, one of the things that I think we ought to discuss today in the context of resilience is where are these extremities coming from and why are they becoming so more frequent? Is it their interconnectedness? Is it other things? What are the reasons behind this? And do we have a system of global governance for managing and preventing, dare I say, some of this? What is really different now than what we used to think maybe 20 years ago? But let me start with the issue of fragilities, which links to resilience, the imbalances that we are seeing the effects of, where they're coming from, what are they, and how they may be different than what we used to think 20 years ago. Let me start with you, Thomas. What's your view on the imbalances? Where are they coming from? What are they?
Yes, very profound questions, Maria. And you referred to the great financial crisis a bit more than 10 years ago, and you could argue, not completely wrongly, that this came from one economic sector and then spread throughout a large part of at least industrialized economies over multiple continents, had its ripple through effects on the euro area as well, of course. And by design and sometimes by pure luck, we managed to cobble together an economic policy response that got us out of this crisis. And some of it was very good, and some of the responses were not quite so good. And that is where I see one of the big differences to today's crisis. Today's crisis, you could argue, is an exogenous shock for everybody, whereas much of the previous crisis was a bit exogenous and a bit endogenous. It is multi-sourced, and it has shown much more than 10, 12 years ago, how fragile our global system is. That is, of course, not because only of the source of the pandemic, that it is a health issue, but it is because of the developments of global governance that have happened in the meantime. This drifting apart of China and the US, Europe questioning, where does it belong? Is it between a rock and a hard place? Increasingly, just think of the WTO. Increasingly, we have to ask ourselves, do we have the global governance that is able to solve global issues? And more we have come to realize, even politicians have started realizing, that very many of the problems we're facing today are global in nature. Just think of the ecological crisis. Think of future pandemic risks. Who would have guessed at the extent of the economic and health effects of the present pandemic? So for me, the difference leading to these imbalances is that risks have become much more multi-sourced, no longer single source shocks. It is a combination of the future crisis where we can expect in all probability maybe a combination of environmental shocks, health shocks, geopolitics, socioeconomics, and the like.
I think already given us the confines of your report, actually, Thomas, that touches exactly on all of these issues, which is not just the one source. We'll come back to the report in a minute, if I may. I wanted to also address the same question to Andre. Thomas talked about ripple effects, which I think is a very nice word of describing the way that shocks are transmitting. Back in the financial crisis, we had a purely economic shock that had ripple effects. This time around, an exogenous shock, that's what Thomas talked about, had multi-sourced risks, and the effects are really much broader and actually, you know, a lot stronger than the previous time. What is different this time, actually? To guide our thinking about the future and what we can expect in the future, how are things evolving in this respect?
So I'm very much in agreement with Thomas in looking, in a sense, at this shock, both backward compared to the financial crisis 10, 12 years ago, and then ahead, the climate shock. I think those are the two points I like to compare this shock to. I mean, in a sense, when I look at the shock that we are undergoing at the moment, the pandemic, as Thomas indicated, I think compared to the global financial crisis, there's both good and bad. In terms of GDP, at least, globally in 2020 was bigger even than the shock that had occurred at the time of the global financial crisis, but it has been shorter in its effects. And yet, indeed, global governance is much weaker today than it was 10 years ago. There's a little bit of a paradox there, and I think an interesting paradox, probably related also to the nature of the shock. A financial crisis, then, and a health crisis now, leading to different issues. But I think on the whole, I find myself, when I evaluate the pandemic shock, I find myself positive, at least from a European perspective, in the manner we handled financial shock 10, 12 years ago. When I compare, on the other hand, the pandemic to the climate problem, then I find myself much less optimistic. I have written someplace that I regard, and I think I put that on the table for discussion, I regard the handling by the global community, I'm not talking at the European level, but by the global community. I regard the handling of the pandemic by the global community as a poor rehearsal for what's coming up for the climate. Indeed, they are both global issues that can only be handled. They're pandemic, right? That's what pandemic means. It's a global issue that needs global solutions. Well, global solutions have not been great in terms of governance. And yet it's a problem which I would regard as, in a sense, much easier to handle than the climate problems that are looming. So I find it a poor rehearsal. I'm worried in the manner we as a global community have handled this shock for our ability to deal with the future shocks that Thomas was talking about, including climate.
So you've touched immediately the governance issue, which I think let's go then straight to that. It's interesting you say that the global governance now is weaker than it was in the financial crisis. I think that's kind of an interesting point. So if you like, we're going the wrong way. I mean, the problems are becoming more global, and yet the governance is becoming weaker to handle this. And let me perhaps turn to Thomas again. And you know, let's go back to the system, the global governance system that we had. We have a system of global governance. Andre is quite sober when it comes to his ability to tackle the problems of the past. So is it the case that the way we've built up this global governance system is just not fit for purpose, given what it lies ahead?
Well, I think what we've found over the last maybe 40 years was that we had a global governance system which essentially was North Atlanticist in its genesis, and North Atlanticist in its teleology. It presupposed that we all were singing from the same hymn sheet of liberal market economies, democracies, Massomino, and that we supposed that more or less free and unfettered trade was good for our economies, i.e. globalization. And if we look at the results, I think we find that what we nowadays call globalization has lifted millions, if not billions, out of abject poverty and has been good for mankind. At the same time, we see that it has had its impact on income distribution, inequality, etc., especially in industrialized economies. But in retrospect, even in 50 years' time, people will say, ah, around the year 2000, China joined the WTO on the presumption of many that it was on a glide path towards being a market economy, maybe not a democracy, but on the glide path towards being a market economy, and therefore could sort of easily fit into the North Atlanticist consensus on how you conduct economic policy and what the rules of the game are. And what we've seen over the last 10 years is that this presumption has not been correct. So as we develop further and further, will we have one system of global governance? And I'm simplifying very much now, of course. Will we have a system of global governance, which is one system, but is so flexible and adjustable and maybe non-binding that it can accommodate market economies and non-market economies? That's not a good outcome. Or will we have a system of global governance where there is one set of institutions and rules for market economies and one set of institutions and rules for those who are not? An even worse outcome. I have no good solution, but I think at least we have to face that question of how we're going to handle this. Or we have a system without rules, which is even worse. So that's one issue that I think we're all struggling with. Second issue, we have had a very siloized, compartmentalized system of global governance. We've had the Bretton Woods institutions, and people have often accused the two sides of the street of not talking to each other. I think this has gotten much better over the last years. But more or less, IMF was in one silo and was very strong on economic policy prescriptions. We had quite disassociated from that. We had the silos regarding trade, GATT, and then WTO. Again, 500 meters as the crow flies, World Intellectual Property Organization, International Standards Organization. And they were all totally operating under their own governance system. And that leads me now to my, for now, concluding remark. What we have come to realize is that increasingly we will not be facing single issue endogenous shocks, but we will be facing multi-issue shocks, which are exogenous to very many. And that is why we need to have a more holistic and systemic way of approaching these issues. We have to have a system of global governance that is able to accommodate these multi-country, multi-source, multi-shock issues. And if you so want, what have I found most lacking in the present crisis and which will be a disaster in the ecological issues to come is maybe 5 points. The most important one was solidarity. If you think of these issues at a global level, we have had tremendous challenges in terms of risk management. You had the feeling that many were sort of inventing it on the hoof or just stumbling or bumbling down the policy corridors. Some of them still are, not mentioning any country. I'm speaking from Austria. We had significant issues in terms of supply chains. If we are talking about ideally sustainable and purposeful supply, this is not what we've been seeing, sometimes for bad reasons, sometimes for good reasons. Governance, that is where what we've been discussing the past couple of minutes. And in terms of inclusion, our growth model simply has not been as inclusive as many would have wished. And I think we see the results on the streets of many countries in Europe.
Thank you. That is actually a prelude to the report. And thank you for doing this, Thomas. But before we go straight to the report, I wanted to also bring Andre in. And I know you've thought and talked about this many, many times. It would be interesting to tell us to repeat a few of these things for our listeners. The North Atlantic model as a basis for designing global cooperation may have been appropriate 20 years ago, but in a world where you have very different economies now come in, there is significant shortcomings, as I would say, which lead also to the silos, right? Andre?
Yes, very much so. Let me agree and disagree with Thomas. Completely agree with him on this issue of the North Atlantic. In a sense, it's clear that the global institutions up to 30, 40 years ago, they were really Western-led, if not US-led institutions. They were essentially, if you look in terms of their philosophies and also who wrote the charters, it was done by British and Americans. So I think with very, very good principles, but maybe sometimes principles that countries that were behind the Iron Curtain or behind other walls, as far as China is concerned, or even India, that was part of the system, but a bit on the margin, those countries did not recognize sometimes themselves as being a major player there. So I think it was always going to be a huge challenge going from that North Atlantic dominated global institution and global thinking about problems to a truly global world where other players, including China, would find a place, even though they do have and they do want to have, at least as far as China is concerned, a different economic system. As I always say, you know, we in Europe, and it is embedded in our treaty, we view our economic political system as one based on the notion of social market economy. And the Chinese view their system as one of socialism market economy. Not a big difference, but a huge difference at the same time. And certainly on top of the systems difference, the systemic rivalry that has come is also a geopolitical question. I think it was always going to be a huge challenge for the world to deal with those questions. I can't say we are doing a great job. It is worrisome. And indeed, this crisis, the pandemic, has not helped in this issue, in sort of the polarization between at least China and the United States, with us, Europe, you know, someplace in between, but much closer, obviously, to the United States at the same time, yet wanting somewhere to bridge the gap. So, yes, it is a big challenge, and it's one that is incumbent upon us to deal with. It's not because it's not easy that it's not important. I would say exactly the opposite.
Excellent.
Because of the importance of the challenges, the pandemic and the climate challenges, it's incumbent upon us to try to find global governance at a time when it's particularly difficult. And that's the real resilience. It's not the resilience of our economies, it's the resilience of the global system, the global system that itself needs to be transformed to some extent. Mm. So they completely agree. Where I agree perhaps a bit less is about the silo issue. Now, it is obviously true that there's always been an issue in Washington itself, you know, the discussion between the World Bank and the IMF, and then between those institutions and other institutions, be it those institutions in Geneva, like the WTO, the WIPO, and all the other institutions. So that problem of the silo is, I think, well recognized as an issue. Nonetheless, I think we have made some progress there. And the name of the progress is G20. In a sense, as the G7 at the time of the North Atlantic domination was playing the role of coordination among those different agencies, it was giving the political guidance. It's not by any chance that before, you know, you had the IMF meeting, you had the G7 meeting. And it's true for all of the big meetings, the G7 was trying to coordinate the view. Now we are trying to do that with the G20. So the silo issue is being addressed. Now, then one can discuss whether the G20 is up to the task. Again, because of the rivalry between China and the United States and what role it plays at the G20. But in a sense, we, the global community, is trying to address the silo issue, is not ignoring it. So we have built an institution, the G20, to try to engineer the needed coordination between the different organizations, the different topics. And I think that is definitely something good, but that's something that dates back from the financial crisis. And that goes back to what I was saying before. That's when we invented the G20 at the leaders level at the time of the financial crisis. I think it was a very useful innovation. And we all remember, obviously, the famous G20 summit in London. That was the high point of the G20 and maybe a high point not to be reproduced anytime soon.
So it's interesting that the G20 is an attempt to, in fact, capture the fact that the problems are global and therefore they require global cooperation. It's a step in the right direction. But as you said, Andrei Youssef, earlier on, you're very sober about the ability to meet the global public goods, climate being perhaps the most important one. So we'll come to this. And I think maybe it's a good point to come to the report. You talked, both of you, about what I would perhaps rather provocatively summarize as a clash of civilizations. I mean, I don't really mean it in a civilization part of the world, but I mean, it effectively boils down to different business models, different ideologies. I don't know, choose a word that fits the narrative and use that. But something is clashing in terms of how we do things, right? And therefore bringing those two clashing partners around the table requires a different way of governing that, right? Now, the G7, which is one side of this negotiation power, it has addressed in this report, Thomas, and I'll come to you. You've identified 7 topics. Perhaps you can tell us what they are for the benefit of our listeners. And perhaps we can zoom in on 1 or 2 if you wanted to sort of identify which are the ones, perhaps the most challenging ones, although I think you've revealed it already, which ones you think are the most challenging ones, but perhaps we can go a little bit deeper and also discuss how you think we should make progress, move from a G7 to G20 and perhaps from G20 to something more effective.
Right, Maria. Well, as you said, G7 leaders commissioned a report by an independent panel where each of the G7 countries and the EU had one personal representative. So this is something which was definitely not influenced by the bureaus of heads of state or government. And we asked ourselves, how should we respond to this crisis and with the manifold social and economic upheavals and imbalances that are emerging? And will we go back to business as usual? Do we sort of hug ourselves and shrink into our shell and move away from more global systems and into something that you would have elements of autarky in it? Or do we try, and that is the tenor of the report, and I think all of my co-authors very much agree, or do we try to strengthen the resilience of the systems that we have and work towards them by diversification, for example, on some of the issues, by creating systems not of dependence, but of codependence, a bit of a maybe too modern word these days, and also by redefining the relative roles of the private and the public sector compared to what we've seen over the last 30 years in some countries, much more pronounced than in others. But this has very much to do with public sector providing infrastructures for health, education, research and development, rethinking the importance of public investment and the like. And whilst we have to be fairly selective, we pinpointed 7 issues which we considered to be the most burning and pressing in terms of this resilience and codependence. And first and foremost, of course, at this juncture, issues of global health. The second issue, also not surprising, climate and the broader environment issues. The third, where the European Union is thinking very deeply these days, are the issues around digital governance, where we are talking about technical standards, about regulation, about antitrust policy, competition policy, fair tax regimes. These are issues, just to go back to our previous discussion, these are issues where the European Union, we can decide on lots of these issues by ourselves, but it's for nothing if we do it by ourselves. This has to be ideally a global standard, global regulations. If we work on antitrust, we have to think very much about third country effects and out of territory applicability of legislation and judgment. So very tricky issues. And fair tax regime, I don't think I need to say much more on this on this issue. It's been very much at the forefront of policymakers' thinkings. We've gotten towards a better solution, which is fine, but which I still consider to be far from optimal. So digital governments as the third issue. Fourth issue, the global trading system, and I've previously referred to all the challenges, so I don't want to repeat myself there. The fifth issue is sort of forward-looking and harps a bit back to what I was just saying about the relative roles of the public and the private sector, that we need an investment-focused recovery, both private sector investment and public sector investment. If you think, for example, of how many of significant innovations and developments in the U.S. Were funded by the government through its DARPA, it simply shows there is a global acknowledgement that the government sector, that the public sector plays a huge role in providing the basis for scientific advancement. And without very scientific advancement very rapidly over the coming 10 years, I don't see where we will land with respect to our climate-related issues, probably in a considerably hotter environment. But this investment-focused recovery is also pertinent, of course, to the questions of inclusion and inequality and participation in our societies, which brings one to the sixth issue, which we highlighted, namely labor standards, labor regulation, participation in labor markets. And that is an issue where André was referring to it. I think in many of the European economies, I think we can look with a certain degree, not high degree, but with a certain degree of satisfaction of how inclusive many of our labor market related policies over the last years have been. But that is something which is maybe not the case for many other non-European economies. But even in Europe, we've got, I think, room for significant improvements there. And last and not least, I've also referred to that, is how one thinks in terms of supply chains and critical market fragilities. Just to give a couple of issues, for example, on rare earth elements, 98% of EU imports stem from China, 98%. Working fine for the moment, but what does one know about the future? There's this, in recent months, very well-known firm, TSMC. 2 years ago, everybody would have said TSMC, but what's that? Is that the cricket club or something? No, Taiwan, chips. Let's leave out geopolitics. Drought in Taiwan in 2021 was produced significant concerns globally about the output of this one firm, which is producing 55% of global chips because production needs lots of water. Add geopolitics, some people are worried. Last figure, 70% of global cobalt is mined in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And that is not only a very concentrated source of this mineral, but is also a bit of a playbill of geopolitics, to put it mildly. So these are the seven issues which we highlighted in our report, which can be found on the website of the UK G7 presidency. But all of them point to the fact that many of the problems which we see on our doorstep for the next 20 or 30 years are stemming from non-economic sources, but will have significant economic effects. They will, if you want to put it slightly dramatically, have some kind of metastatic effects over a wide swathe of our sectors and countries. And over time, if we continue to have to fight these economic crises with the very significant fiscal response that we've had, people will also start worrying about aggregate debt levels, private and public. So at the end, very much of this ends up on the balance sheet of sovereigns, and that is not where we want too many problems either. I'll stop here.
Thank you so much for that very, very good summary, I think, actually, of your report. We'll have to discuss a little bit what to do about all this. The numbers you quote were really heart stoppers, actually. When I read your report, the numbers are actually quite striking. 98% dependence on China when it comes to these rare elements, which are needed both for the digital and the green transition, if I may say. But before we come to some more details on the policy and what to do about it, Andrea, this is a list of, I'm sure you agree. I mean, if there's something you think you is missing from there, please tell us. But what I would like you to do is give us a sense of urgency. I thought the numbers on the digital were particularly urgent, but what is your take on this?
Look, I find it very hard
to choose.
No, not only to choose, but first to disagree with the list. As a list written in 2021, so the year here is crucial, obviously. This is a report written in 2021 to deal with the issues of the day. And, you know, do I see any issues that has been left out? No. It starts with global health. Okay, we all would agree that, global health, where we are now, is number one. And then climate, digital, you know, hard to disagree with any of those things. And do I see a priority? No. I mean, I think it's all fine. I don't take that list of seven as, you know, one more important than the others. Now, let me, however, disagree with something. I do wish, and there I come with my contrarian view, I do wish that the report that wants to put forward the Cornwall consensus had not done a packaging, I would say almost pull a stunt, by positioning itself as the Cornwall consensus against a outdated Washington consensus. I really think that's besides the point. It's all nice to get some headlines in some newspapers, but I think really it's not the correct way of looking at the issues. Let's sort of go back a moment about what the Washington consensus was meant to be, at least on the part of its author, John Williamson, a famous British economist who spent much of his professional career in the United States and mostly actually in Washington, both in the institutions, at the World Bank, at the IMF, and mostly at the Institute for International Economics, today called the Peterson Institute of International Economics. Now, John Williamson coined the expression Washington Consensus also at a particular moment in time. That was 1989. And in a particular context, that was the Latin American debt crisis. And he organized a conference back in 1989, held at the Peterson Institute of International Economics. And the conference was called Latin American Adjustment, How Much Has Happened? And he convened a number of authors, asked them to write papers on different topics, and he produced a background paper for the authors sort of to frame the conference. And in that background paper, authored by John Williamson, a paper called What Washington Means by Policy Reform, there he uses this expression of the Washington consensus. And Washington to him is Washington, both the US Washington, the Treasury, essentially, and the international Washington, the IMF and the World Bank. And so he talks to the Latin American countries and that, you know, what is the view in Washington about what you, the countries in Latin America, in the midst of coming out of this debt crisis, what is it that you should do as reforms? And he builds on a book that had been published in 1986, also by the Peterson Institute, called Toward Renewed Economic Growth in Latin America, authored by my PhD thesis advisor, Bella Balassa, and three Latin American economists. And what is that Washington consensus? It's 10 points. I'm not going to go over the 10 points, but sort of it boils down to three things. Number one, disciplined macroeconomic policies. Number two, the use of markets, not the centrality, but the use of markets. Number three, trade liberalization. Now, it seems to me that as recommendation for the Latin American countries back in 1989, or for any country that is seeking to reform its economic policies, those three principles, they are still very, very valid principles. And those principles, neither nor the principles, nor John Williamson was a extreme ideologue. And as some of you may have read John Williamson, later he objected to people associated the Washington Consensus as some kind of a Reagan-Thatcher plot to take over the world and to dominate the world with some kind of Reagan-Thatcher extreme views of market fundamentalism. That was not his purpose, and that was not the purpose of the Washington Consensus. And that's what I found a little unhelpful in the report, sort of positioning the Cornwall Consensus, with which I agree, and responding to the issues that we have to deal with, and to collective problems. This is really about collective problems, how the world needs to respond to health issue, environment, and all of those matters. And then recommendation that are done about how to reform your domestic economic policies, which is what the Washington Consensus is about. And I fear that the report could be misused by some would say, no, this notion about disciplined macroeconomic policies, that's old stuff. That's Washington Consensus. Now we have moved forward to a new consensus, a Cornwall Consensus, and disciplined macroeconomic policies doesn't matter anymore. That, I think, would be a very bad message in my view. And I hope that it will be dispelled by some of its authors.
So by writing the word consensus, it's setting itself to replace the Washington. What are you saying? It actually builds on, and indeed it should, because the problems are very different. Interesting point. I'm also watching at the time, and I wanted to ask one or two more questions when it comes to the report, to what we can then call the Cornwall, but not necessarily consensus, the build-up of a new framework for addressing the new challenges. Thomas, I wanted to come back to you because you actually started with that. You started with the five principles, which are actually outlined also in the report of how to attempt the problems of the day. And you know, you talk about inclusion, governance, sustainability. You talk about solidarity, which I think is a very interesting thing. You know, we haven't done very well in exhibited solidarity, though, have we? Think about the health issues. What percentage of the world population is vaccinated as a metric for measuring solidarity? Think about COP26, which just came out of this last week, and we still haven't found the finance. We still didn't finish the finance that we need to try and make sure, as the principle of solidarity would dictate, that we apportion the responsibility according to capacity. But also what I'd like to say, previous sins, you know, when it comes to health, we have contributed, we being Europe, the Western world, the North American Washington Consensus has contributed to the pollution of this world. And you know, are we looking inside, attributing the right responsibility to this? How do we make progress so that we are credible when it comes to the rest of the world and we bring the rest of the world in our governance system, in our trade deals that we tell them in a credible way on board? Thomas, easy question for you.
Goodness. Maybe I'd start off by saying that none of my co-authors would have any quarrel with what Andre was saying about the genesis of the Washington Consensus, but that many of us would have quarrels with how it has, over the intervening 30 years, morphed into the popular perception of policymakers, some less clever than others. And the same goes, for example, if you think of what is the role of an open trading system? And the report very much underlines the positive effects that stem from countries and continents and regions linked to each other by a fair and open trading system. But we highlight the problems that come from unfair competitive practices and systemic dichotomies, if you so want. And the same goes for more general economic policymaking. Nobody would question the importance of sound and solid macroeconomic policies. But I think Andre and I would very much agree on a number of European examples of where fiscal policy has been unorthodox, in the one direction, but also in the other direction. So that being said, I would say that we have discovered to our detriment how in each and every member state, important segments of the public sector have been totally ignored, pared down over the last 20, 30, 40 years. If I think of the quality of the health sector in many countries, this has been the victim of misguided fiscal policies. Again, to André, I'm not talking against fiscal discipline. I'm talking about the composition of public expenditure. Health systems, a disaster in many countries. In some countries, they've for a long time been a disaster. In others, they have simply declined in quality over the last 30 years. The preparedness of the public sector in general. How is it able to run risk management exercises? Are politicians interested in the day after tomorrow at the expense of today? In very few countries. So, yes, we have to start with each and every of our countries to make the public sector more resilient, intelligent, more meritocratic, if you so want, less nepotistic. And only on the basis of that can one then come to intelligent, joint, solidaric solutions, first and foremost in the European Union, but also globally. Secondly, is the global governance system fit for purpose? I think we all agree here. It is not. What shall we do? Shall we try and be very aspirational and say, oh, we need a new Bretton Woods conference and we totally reform the whole global system? That ain't gonna work. And it, apart from it ain't gonna work, it'll be too late for many of the issues such as climate. So we need to work in smaller groups of like-minded countries to try and reform either the system from within or to find amongst a relevant and statistically relevant subgroup of countries, solutions for health and climate and so on. Ideally, for digital standards and other issues. But that is the big question, I think. How do we cooperate beyond our borders? And we are extremely privileged to be within the European Union because we've got an institutional framework within which we can cooperate. And that is, it makes our life much better. But beyond the European Union, what are the algorithms for coming to intelligent solutions within the WHO? What is the algorithm for coming to intelligent solutions at the follow-up to COP26? Very, very difficult. And that is why I think as Europe, we have to be trailblazers in terms of taking sometimes unilateral action on climate, in showing greater solidarity with countries outside the European Union who cannot afford to take the necessary steps. Will we just transfer money without any strings attached? And here I am thinking that within the European Union, with the Next Generation EU, we have had very good example of providing money on the basis of an agreed program for risk mitigation, solidarity, reforms, and so on. And why not spread that out on a more important regional basis far beyond Europe? So these are the issues. Think in terms of significant national reforms. Try and bring that to the table within Europe. This is a role for the European Council and the Commission, especially, I think, the Commission, but with takes two to tango. And try to be part of smaller reform-oriented groups that try to come to grips with the global governance issues that we have. So in the interest of time, I think we could talk for days on end and bore our listeners until they fall asleep. But for now, these, I think, are the necessary steps which need to be undertaken.
Indeed. Thank you so much, Thomas. I will give now the floor to André for his final thoughts. I understand the need for progress, which is easier to achieve with like-minded countries. But the problems that we have require the cooperation of all, including non-like-minded countries. So while I understand they want to talk to like-minded countries, I urge us to think about how to talk to non-like-minded countries, because that's where the real progress will come. Andre, your final thoughts before we close this episode.
Well, my final thought is exactly your final thoughts.
Oh, well, okay. Sorry for
all of you. The hard nut to crack is indeed between not like-minded countries. So I think now it's a question of strategy. And there, I mean, I need to defer to much wiser people than me. Do we think, and I hope it may be the case, so I'm not saying that in a negative manner, quite on the contrary, do we think that agreement among the like-minded countries, which is obviously easier, not completely easy, but easier, do we think that that would be a good stepping stone towards then the much more difficult problem, which is an agreement, maybe of a different nature, but between the like-minded and the not like-minded countries, if you wish, between the G7 in a sense and China, to put it very, very basically. If the G7 could agree and then sort of a common position, then do we believe that indeed it makes it easier to negotiate with the Chinese and with others? And if that is the case, then it's well and good, obviously. Or is it the other way around, that China will have difficulty, in a sense, to negotiate with us on the basis of a document that will be felt to be take it or leave it? And we leave it little space except rejecting it. So that is something, as I said, it's much beyond my pay grade. I can't answer that question. I wish I could. And that's why I need to refer to wiser and weaser people.
Let's hope we find them.
That's absolutely wonderful. Thank you, Andre, for this very, very, very thoughtful final remark. I think that will be, and perhaps I can commit you to come back in another episode and discuss exactly this point. I think this is absolutely crucial in terms of building up a strategy that would help us deal with the global public goods, climate being, of course, the imminent one. But I'm afraid that's all we have time for today, at least. But let me thank you both for joining us in this episode, and let me thank you, the listeners, for taking the time to join us in this episode. You can find all of our podcasts and the products of Bruegel at our website, www.bruegel.org. Thank you for joining us, and see you next time.